everybody. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. A little hoarse tonight. My sobriety date is March 22nd, 1985, and for that I am truly grateful. Mark Houston was my sponsor, so it's always really special to be out here. In fact, we're within a week of the third anniversary of the day he died. I believe it was February 19th. Was it? It was right around. That'd be tomorrow. I think it was the 19th. Anyway, it's great to be out here. It's really great seeing all the family members here. I was so poorly treated as a child that I left home at the age of 28 for good. One of our founders was Dr. Bob, and he liked to tell jokes. And one of his favorite jokes that I really relate to was this guy that was talking about all the trouble that his son had been for the family, and he's telling a friend of his about it, and his friend says, "Well, I can tell you one thing, if that was my son, I'd kick his ass out." And the guy goes, "I agree with you. If he was your son, I'd kick his ass out too." Thank God for that. My job tonight is to introduce Katie, and it's a real honor. Katie's sober a lot longer than I am, and I'm sure she'll talk about that. I can say a couple of the things. I've known Katie for 27 years, I guess. And we were litter mates in AA, and there was a little pack of us that used to run around to all the meetings and picnics and tube in the river and stuff. And we're having a lot of fun then. We're having a lot of fun now. But we've been a couple for 10 years, and the thing I can tell you about Katie that she won't say about herself is that she is, I'm very fortunate I get to move around Alcoholics Anonymous on a national level. We get to do a lot of stuff in AA and go to 30 or 40 conferences a year, and I don't know anybody that's more active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous than your speaker tonight. She sponsors a ridiculous amount of women. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I live with her, and I pay her cell phone bill. It's constant. You know, she's on the treadmill, and it's like selfishness and self-centeredness. Or, you know, outright. This morning, she was on the treadmill going, outright mental defective. You know, full flat from reality. And I was like, well, she's going out there. But Mark Houston changed our life, and to get to come out here is always an honor for us. And the biggest joy of my sobriety is getting to do it with Katie. She is absolutely the best at hearing inventory of anybody I've ever seen. I put her up against anybody in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She probably sponsors 50 women, and she's real serious, and she has a lot of fun doing this deal. I can't wait to hear what she's going to say. Come up here, Katie.
Hi, y'all. My name is Katie Parker. I am an alcoholic. And I'd like to request that if there's somebody sitting next to you with their cell phone on their lap, that you would please turn it off. I don't like them silenced. I don't like you texting about me back and forth. And so I ask that you turn it off. Yeah, you know, look what you just said there, huh? What do you think about that? It's like, turn that shit off. The disease of alcoholism is a life or death situation. Anybody in here ever lost anybody to alcoholism? Raise your hand. So turn your cell phone off. We're talking about life and death. I take it very, very seriously. I'm also about having a ton of fun. I've been sober since October the 28th of 1984, and that is 5.5 months longer than my husband. And that is a big deal. People say time don't matter. It does. In our house, when Charlie's having a little trouble, I say, "Honey, in about 5.5 months, it'll make more sense to me." I know you're struggling now, but we're very fond of Mark Houston. And how many of you guys had the privilege of knowing Mark? Yeah, he was an amazing man. And one of the things about Mark that I loved so much was he changed Charlie and I's life 10 years ago. Changed our life, or 7, 8, somewhere in there. And one of the things I love that Mark would ask me was, he said, Katie, come out here and I'd like for you to speak to the families. And I have a knack at speaking to the families. I'm an alcoholic. I cause tremendous havoc on my family. And I have a son who I'd like to think may or may not be one of us, but I can tell you, I am the poster child of tough love. I never worked an Al-Anon program. I didn't need one. I'm alcoholic. I worked my AA program. You guys that are not alcoholic have got to work an Al-Anon program, period. Not go to their meetings. You need to work their 12 steps. You need to be able to get in touch with the power that you can say no to your children, period. And one of the things about that, I mean, I am the poster child of tough love. Ask my children, ask my husband, ask my sponsees. And ask his stepchildren, for God's sakes, you should see you. And my husband says he didn't leave home till he's 28. I could just slap his mother, you know. Who's still living at home at 28? You know, he wrecked every one of her cars. He did the pawn shops with them 3 times. And he still was welcome in that home. See, the disease of alcoholism will chew you up and spit you out. And we'll have tremendous remorse for it. And you'll just grow to just be dead inside. It's heartbreaking. And so we struggle a lot. We struggle a lot with his kids. You know, I do. Let me put it to you that way. Because I say kick them to the curb. Because the disease of alcoholism has got to be stopped. And it says in our book, I love this. My husband also refers to me as a kind of like taking a drink out of a fire hose. Sometimes you get a little bit more than you were expecting. And I have the privilege of coming out here twice a month and talking to the clients. And never been real. I prefer to say the pain in the ass, but it says in the doctor's opinion, it says frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Did I say that correctly? Yes, suffices. Thank you. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people, so just think of who the alcoholic people are we're talking about, must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideas must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So no matter how much you beg them, no matter how much you bargain with them, no matter how much you plead, it doesn't touch us. Never has, never will. Makes us feel terrible. We're not sociopaths. We're alcoholic. And alcoholism, understanding the disease of alcoholism, the parents have got to understand the disease. If your children were in here with a rare cancer, I guarantee you would Google it, you would talk to every specialist, you would take them to another country if they needed it. And alcoholism, you drop them off at treatment a lot of times, and you just hope for the best. You pray a lot. And you don't really get educated on what the disease of alcoholism is all about. The disease of alcoholism, there's two problems with me. I suffer from what's called an allergy. I suffer from the allergy. Oh, I'm using yours. I know, I wasn't going to. The allergy and the obsession. These are the two problems I have with alcoholism, with alcohol. Alcohol or drugs. Now the first one, the allergy, it's when I put alcohol in my body has an abnormal physical reaction. See, what alcohol does for me, if you're not alcoholic, it doesn't do the same for you. Matter of fact, you start to feel pretty good. After about 3, you're starting to feel out of control. After about 2, I need a third one. My third one needs a fourth one. My fourth one needs a fifth one. After that, all bets are off. And see, what ends up happening with that allergy, guys, is once I take that drink, I don't even know that I've triggered the allergy. I just think I've changed my mind. And so when I go in to drink, I swear to God this time I'm only going for a couple of drinks. I got a kid at home. I've got to go home tonight. I cannot pull an all-nighter again. I just can't. And I have no idea I've got this allergy. We didn't talk like that out there at the bars. I didn't walk into the bar and go, hey, Billy, man, the whole time I've had this malady kicking my ass, man. And I know once I take that drink, I'm going to trigger that allergy and I'm off to the races, but let me have it anyway. I just went in and said, I'll take a drink. And what ends up happening, guys, is if all I had was that allergy, What would you do? If you were allergic to cats, what do? You stay away from cats. You don't even go to somebody's house who has had a cat. Right? Because what it does to you, the way that allergy shows up, your eyes swell up, your neck, you know, gets all puffed up. But when the allergy to alcohol shows up in what we call the phenomenon of craving, it means I got to have more. I got to have more. So if the allergy was all I suffered from, what would be my solution? Don't drink. But see, then that comes with the second problem comes in, and that's the obsession. And what ends up happening with that obsession is I am against any sort of mental consequences. Nothing, anything I have does not get me to think the drink through. That will not work for me. I cannot remember a week or a month ago my pain and suffering. I am without defense against that drink. Now, I don't understand it, but it's the truth. And so what I have is this amazing spiritual awakening. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I remembered looking at those steps thinking, I knew that whole God deal was in this thing. These people are in a cult. I really believe they're out there smoking pot in the parking lot, but whatever. I've died and ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sakes. I mean, none of us go in there going, I'd like to be the queen of AA. And but what you got to understand about the disease of alcoholism is that you got this allergy and you got this mental obsession. The problem is, when I don't drink, I suffer from this malady that I am restless, irritable, and discontented. Now, personally, I think it ought to say neurotic, psychotic, and can do any damage to anyone. But restless, irritable, and discontent is what the doctor decided to say. And so restless, irritable, and discontent. So when you take away the drugs and alcohol, it's like somebody turns the fire up on my problems. How many of you guys have had your children in more than one rehab? Raise your hand. How many of you guys have had your husband or wife in more than one rehab? Is it mainly just kids that are here? Lovely. Making your parents proud. And, always love it. You love it. You're the alumni of Benchmark. I think they'd rather have you the alumni of Yale. But, I love the alumni. It gives us a level of credibility. But one of the things, guys, about the disease of alcoholism, I love the next part of the book that talks about, you know, you parents need to be studying this book. Read it, study it, get into an Al-Anon program that does it based out of our big book. It says, we believe the big book is the deal. We believe that the big book has the solution in it. And it says, now what was the one I was going to read? Oh, here it is. An illness of this sort, alcoholism, and we have come to believe it is an illness, and it is not a moral problem. I am not a moral weakling. Trust me, I want to quit drinking as bad as you want me to quit drinking. I just can't stop. Period. It's not important to figure out why. It's nothing you parents did. I hope you realize that. It would be no different if I had diabetes in the family and nobody else did. You wouldn't sit there and try to figure out why I had it. I got it. And the disease of alcoholism, I got it. My brother's got it. My sister doesn't. And my sister's whacked. You know, I think that the one that's not the alcoholic's more whacked than the alcoholic, if you want to ask me. I mean, I really do. You guys do not get inebriated. You know, that takes all of that away. You go through this feeling, every feeling, and that'll make you neurotic. Make you psychotic, make you crazy, won't it? Yeah. Involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person had cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one's angry or hurt. But not so with alcoholic illness. For with it there goes, destroying of all the things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, should be parents, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. See, this disease is so ugly. And if when you got here, did you hear all the talking and all the laughter? We alcoholics, we're a sick lot of people, man. We are outright mental defects, full flight from reality, and we cannot differentiate the true from the false. My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Parents would be horrified if they knew what we were doing. They should never know what we're doing, by the way. And I mean that. There's no going to your family and disclosing some of the stuff you've done. It's too painful. I'm a parent. Trust me, I don't want to know what my son did. I want him to get sober and quit asking me for money. All right? I'm sick of giving you money. So, hopefully out of this deal, you parents will learn to say no until you work the 12 steps that will get you in touch with the power. See, the same 12 steps that I have to work get me to be able to not have the obsession to drink. It's been removed, right? For you parents, you need to work the 12 steps so you can say no to your children. It's counterintuitive to what you normally do. When your kids get out, you don't need to pay their car payment. You don't need to pay their insurance. You don't need to pay their damn cell phone. You need to say no and then watch them work. It's shocking. I come out here, especially the boys, which, by the way, I would not have had you at my butt angle, by the way. But that is not where I'd put the boys. They have been separated from women for too long. And but one of the things I tell these boys, and I say the same thing to the girls, is that I said, when you get out of here, get a job and get a 40-hour-a-week job. Do not get a 20-hour-a-week. Who works 20 hours a week? Go get a job. And you need to get a job because you need self-esteem. You need to get a job because you don't need to sit anywhere in your head. This level of selfishness and self-centeredness, see, that's the root of our problem. I was talking to some parents a few days ago. I'm very passionate about this parent Al-Anon group in Austin. I went and spoke there on a fluke. And when it just makes me want to cry. When I sit there and look out at about 50 to 100 sets of parents who are just holding each other, they're like they're on a boat that's sinking. They're so desperate. And these little pain in the asses here are running the show. See, they are. They are running the show. Somebody has got to stop it. And all you're doing is based on the fact that you're scared to death they're going to kill themselves. That's it. And you know what? We're not. We are like a cockroach. I swear to God, we are. If you're from Texas, you know what a cockroach is. So you got a big old cockroach. You go step on it. You see about four legs blow off, right? You hear the pop. You run to get a wad of paper towels. You're not going to use tissue. And you come back in there, and the damn thing is gone. The legs are still laying there, and the cockroach is gone. That's the alcoholic, guys. Yeah, absolutely. And we see, and what's so sad is we will let you enable us to no end. And it's the worst thing you can do for the disease. And you know what you can do? You could pray. A lot of prayers. For some reason, God's got an extra special little dose of God for us. He really does, man. I think he just loves drunks. You know, you get all those really wonderful do-gooders, and I think we get more blessings personally. But, you know, we are just the scum of the scum. We really are. What we do to families, how we will steal from you. From our own family. Steal. You raised us with values. You raised us with morals. and we come and steal from you. You steal from me, you don't get welcome in my home again. Period. You don't get to do that. Because you've got to have consequences. Your behavior must have consequences. And believe it or not, they're screaming for consequences. Aren't you? Yeah. See? But we really are. We really are screaming for you to stop. But it won't look that way. It will look like we're begging you to help us. And this is the line you use. I love you so much. No. And please don't call back again. Click. I just had a was talking to these parents that I'm so moved by. I've had it's given Alcoholics Anonymous an opportunity to do 12-step work. And this is I'm at a recovery center which I happen to be very fond of. If we must send them to recovery, this is the only place I support. But I don't always believe you have to. You know, after these kids have been through here, get it together. You don't get it together, that was our one shot. Do not mortgage your life. Don't do it. And if you can't say no to it, work those 12 steps so you can. So I go to this Al-Anon meeting, I'm talking to these families, I'm absolutely moved by what God's saying to me. And he says, you need to help them, Katie. Well, I really don't like helping untreated Al-Anons. You're really hard to talk to. You explain to the point to nauseam. You really do. Because if you can explain to me enough, I will understand your pain. Oh, I understand your pain. Remember, I'm alcoholic and my son is gotten on the straight and narrow. Still has a lot of tendencies that look to me like he's something. But the verdict's still out. And I kicked his ass out at 15. So don't underestimate. He ended up coming back 3 different times. But because the law told me I had to. Now that piss off some of you guys that are tough love. But they told me I had to. And because he went and told them I did, right? He went and told the school. And see, we're crafty. But by the time he was 18, he was out. And that's what I believe you do. You're out. I'm done. And he's got his life together. He's married. He's got a wonderful wife. He's got a little baby. And life is really good for my son. And I was tough. I was very, very tough. But these families, they just break my heart. I'm watching them, right? And I'm just seeing them looking like they're sinking. And they started calling me. And I said, let me offer you guys a suggestion. Call me the next time your kid calls you crying. Call me the next time your kid's bugging you to take them to treatment again. Yeah, come up with $9,000, $30,000 again. And you're desperate. And so we've had the opportunity to do at least 8 12-step calls. Of course, you know, the neurotic parents got to call 19 times to figure out what the hell's going on. Because they're so damn scared. It's like, my message is a message of death, weight, and Connie, I'm not talking to you because I do enjoy talking to you. I do enjoy, because I swear to God, they are the poster parents for tough love with their daughter. Are they not?
Yes.
You were a tough one, Missy. And but they were the poster parents. And I told her, I said, you go back to that Al-Anon meeting. And you tell them how you did it. They need to hear it. I don't care. No, nobody's going to like it. It's not a popularity contest. I'd rather step on your toes than stand on your grave. If this disturbs anyone, good. It should. It's life or death. And so we've had this opportunity to do this amazing 12-step work. And there's a guy that brought his parents to the AA meeting. How weird is that? I mean, I don't mind if they go to an AA meeting, but let's not go with your children. Okay? Are y'all hearing me? Let's not go with your children. Let's let them have their recovery. And so these parents come to this meeting with him, and I don't think, he's working an angle, I can tell. We did a little 12-step work with him. It didn't look like it was really sinking in. He looked like he was manipulating the whole situation, because that's the root of my problem, right? So he comes to the meeting, and I'm standing there talking to the parents, and they said, listen, our son has been narcissistic all his life. long before he ever drank or did drugs. He was just had this level of selfishness that was just unnatural. And I said, well, let me explain something to you. In our book, as I encourage you to read, it says on page 62 what the root of our problem is. Selfishness and self-centered, that we think is the root of our trouble. We are driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows, they retaliate, seeming without provocation, but we invariably find that sometime in the past we made a decision based on me that later placed me in a position to be hurt. That's not a manipulator. That's in the core of my being. I am absolutely blinded to my effect on you. I'm that self-centered. I'm not stingy, I'm not conceited. All I think of me. I don't think too much of me or too little of me. All I think about is me. And I don't even know I'm thinking about me when I'm thinking about me. I'm telling you, that should give you a brain cramp. I mean, it's tough. And it says, even behind a kind motive. So up walks Mr. trying to suck up to his parents, and I'm trying to give him this whole talk that he does not need outside help. He needs Alcoholics Anonymous. He doesn't need counseling. He can get it later. Right now, we got to get him into the AA program. We got to get him into service. We got to get him into doing what we think he should be doing, not what you think. And so the kid walks up, and of course I say kid, he's 33. Still living at home. Because he doesn't have me as a mother. And I said, hey, hold on, I'm having a visit with your folks. And he goes, listen, I just wanted to tell you, they're going to hang out after the meeting. And I think he's going to say, and I'd like to hang out with them. Now he's going to go play on the playground with us. But instead he goes, but I've decided I'd really like to hang out with you two tonight. That's such bullshit. Are you with me? I looked at him, I thought, oh, you are so full of shit. I went, you know, yo, bye-bye, bye-bye. And I looked at him and I said, now that right there is him working an angle. And they're like, what? They were so excited that he wanted to hang out with us. No, he wants to just keep working them over. How many of y'all really want to hang out with your parents? Come on. Even you parents don't want to hang out with your parents. Are you with me on that? We're always working an angle, guys. We don't mean to be. It's the nature of my illness. And that's what the biggest problem here is. Is you get me a few years sober and really doing this deal, and you will see a character change. That psychic change, I'm a different person. I'm actually at the Thanksgiving Day meal, and I'm enjoyable. I'm not the one in there like Eeyore with no tail. I'm not the lazy one sitting there, you know, while everybody else is doing stuff. I'm not the one talking the entire time about me. I'm actually amongst the family. And that's pretty spectacular. It's pretty darn spectacular when you see it. You know, I left home at 15. I've had the privilege. I lost my father unexpectedly about 15 years ago, and my father and I were exactly alike. So we didn't get along at all. For you guys that have your kids that are just like you, you know what I'm talking about. That's what the biggest problem is. As a matter of fact, usually the biggest problem, the enabler, or at least my experience, is if it's a daughter, the dad's the enabler, and if it's a son, the mother is. And every once in a while, you mothers just do both sides. But the worst enabler in the world. You know, you do stuff like you send your kids stuff while they're at rehab. Stop it. You know why? If this is not summer camp. They are here because they have destroyed the family. Whatever they need, they can get it theirself. So stop all of it. And that's the thing, that's what, I can't even begin to tell you guys. When I left home at 15, my mother died when I was 8. It was just horrific. We were upper middle America, you know, we lived in Houston, and life was just grand. And, the, you know, overnight my mother dies of a kidney disease. And it was just heartbreaking. I was the youngest of three, and we were all 2 years apart. It was me and my sister and my brother. And we just had what I thought was great family. My dad was a heavy drinker, but it was a party and family. It was the 60s. I mean, it was just fabulous. And alcohol flowed freely at our home. And one of the things that I realized was when my mother died, my dad remarried three times in an 18-month period. He was desperately looking for a mother for the children. We had four live-in housekeepers. So I had, seven women come through my life in an 18-month period. And I'll tell you, today I'd have swore to God that's what made me alcoholic. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I really believe that that's what made me alcoholic. If anything could make you alcoholic, that'd be it. You need to drink too. And the truth of the matter is I find out that I suffer from an illness. Now, that influenced my old ideas. You heard when she read How It Works. We got to let go of our old ideas, absolutely. The result was nil. And one of the things that we call them belief systems in this day and age, prejudice. Old ideas are just what I formed throughout my life. You parents have one. What an alcoholic is. They're a lowlife until it's your child. And then all of a sudden you have to start looking at that a little differently. You got to look at your old ideas as much as we have to look at our old ideas. And one of the things that I can tell you is this: when I was going through life, I had all these old ideas about women and all men and all of this stuff. Well, this stepmother and I, the last one that lasted, she was tough. God dang, I mean, I am her. You know, she was tough. And at 15, my parents had it. See, what we tend to do is we cause havoc between you parents. Would you agree? Some of your biggest fights are over us. Charlie and I have the same situation. He likes to pretend like we don't, but we do. Over his youngest daughter. I'd kick her ass to the curb in a heartbeat, but I can't get my husband to do that. And so I have to watch this slow progression. And it kills me. It just kills me. Mm-hmm. I said it out loud in front of everybody. Honey. I'm just going to enjoy that moment. Oh yeah, it's always going to splash on you. But now remember, we're talking old ideas. He didn't leave home till he was 28. He wrecked every car his mother had. And he made the rounds with his father for his father's stuff at the pawn shops three times. His old ideas say, that's what you do. You see, don't get me wrong. I know this is deep, deep seated in him. And my parents kicked my ass out at 15. So, do you see what I'm talking about, old ideas? We have old ideas, and these say they work. And so I've had the privilege of having rekindling this relationship with this stepmother in the last 5 years. It's been unbelievable. And I went down there to the hospital. She's in Houston. And I got to show up. Right? I've made the amends and now I got to show up, and trust me, I'm so self-centered, I really don't want to. I just want to make the amends. I want her to be happy for me, and I really don't want to show up. See, that's what we self-centered alcoholics really are dealing with up here. If you had a little microphone to my head, it's pretty ugly up there. You know, I see one of you guys texting, I'm pointing you out. I mean, that's how I am. I'm just that kind of girl. And so I go down there because I know I have to. And the whole time, I don't want to. And once I'm there, it's wonderful. God's grace is so fabulous to me. And we're sitting there visiting, and we always mention when I left home. Because to kick a girl out at 15 is pretty darn scary. You're basically putting a womb on the curb. And that can yield many children. And that's tough, right? And she started to cry this last time, and she said, you know, I always regretted doing that to you. And I said, golly, Mom, it was the best thing you could have ever done to me. I would have destroyed you and Dad. And she said, the one thing I loved about your father is I could tell him it was a good thing and he would follow suit. So see, they were both working together. I sobered up 11 years later. I sobered up when I was 26. Would that be 11 years?
Okay.
It was either 9 or 11. I can't remember if I took away or added to. Chad helped me there. But I looked at her and I said, you know, that was, and I made her look at me right now. I said, best thing you could have ever done. Because see, from that point on, I was responsible for everything. Yes, I did get pregnant. And I got pregnant and I had that child. She's 33 today. She's not one of us. But she suffers from untreated Al-Anon. Let me tell you, she is a worry wart. And if she doesn't have something to worry about, she'll find out what you're worrying about, and she'll worry about that. Bring your worries to me, because I'm not comfortable unless I'm worrying. Really, the alcoholic is like this. Whatever. Rent's due. Whatever. You know, they don't really worry as much, let me tell you. But one of the things that I absolutely loved is that conversation that we had, because we were able to talk about it. And when I made the amends to her, I never got to make the amends to my father. And let me tell you, we were, wow, you parents know what I'm talking about. We were just like this when we get together. We were so much alike, and I'm such a fighter. I'm the kind of personality that takes a step forward when I get scared. I do not take a step back. Never have, probably never will. That doesn't make me a unique alcoholic. Book tells me that what I'm looking for is how I show up. Self-manifested in various ways is what causes my failure. Your child could be that absolute invisible personality. Never speaks up for themselves. Never says a word. That's how their alcoholism shows up. That's not how my alcoholism shows up. Not at all. And I was talking with Evelyn. I said that the type of person, Evelyn's my stepmother, I said the type of person I have become, I really believe, has to do with the fact that you and Dad stood up for yourselves. You just wouldn't take it. And even today, she talks a lot about her son. And I don't think he's alcoholic. I don't know what he is. And that's a shame. He's just a walking disaster. But he never has it with alcohol. So, you know, I'm very grateful that I suffer from the disease of alcoholism. One of the things, too, guys, when we talk about, a lot of times parents will say things like, my son or daughter, is they're manipulative. They're controlling. That's almost too therapeutic, right? We are driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. That's a mouthful. I suffer from a spiritual disease of delusion. When I say outright mental defect, full flight from reality, and I cannot differentiate the true from the false. Today looks like yesterday, yesterday looks like last week, and last week looks like last month. It's all the same. I didn't go down the tubes in a week. It just went like this. And I can't see this. I only see this. So I've thrown out my moral compass. I've thrown out my values. I've started doing stuff that would make your toenails curl. And that's what I do. And that's the work I gotta face. I don't need to put a sticker on the mirror that says, I love myself. It's not a bad plan, but it won't touch my disease. See, the problem is I got to go back and I got to clean up all the mess. And the clients will love this line. So when they come back to you and they ask you if they can make financial amends for all the money that they cost you, the only acceptable answer is yes. Oh, the peanut gallery. And with that answer, you two sit down and figure out how much that child has cost you. And they will pay you back slowly. And it's a spiritual principle, guys. It's the law. Make them do that. It goes against every fiber of your being. I'm going to tell you what I did to my son. He had, oh Jesus, he was such a pain in the ass. I had lost my husband. I was married for 20 years to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Joe and I had met. That's why Charlie and I have been together for 10 years. Charlie was our best friend. We had met. I was 10 minutes sober. He was 6 years sober. It's just a match made in heaven, don't you hear? And so we get together and we get married. 19 days, he's moving in. That's what we do. Don't be shocked if you see your kids do this. Just don't support them financially, right? Just let them go. And so Joe moves in and we have this amazing life for 20 years. It had its goods and bads and pros and cons, but we really tried to do the deal. He got very, very sick with a brain tumor. And little did I know that we were sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in what I call untreated alcoholism. It's rampant in our fellowship. People don't even know it. How do you know what you don't know, man? And they think that they go to 5 meetings a week and that's sufficient. And if they step on my toes, they make an amends. Good enough. And they try to do service work. And that's what I did. I did that for a long, long time. And I really believed I was working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Mark Houston was the one that absolutely changed my life. I hadn't even dipped a toe in the water of what the book talks about. I wasn't doing 10 steps. I wasn't doing evening review. I wasn't doing prayer and meditation. I wasn't intensely working with other alcoholics like I am today. I have been rocketed into the fourth dimension. I am in the realm of the spirit, period. I didn't even know what that was, but I thought I was in it. No, I wasn't even close to the edge of it. And I'm living it, man. I am living it. But it was because when all of a sudden Joe and I are tooling along and he's got this massive brain tumor, right? And in this brain tumor, it was just terrible. It was devastating. Book says, for if an alcoholic fails to enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he cannot handle certain trials and low spots ahead. Well, let me tell you, a brain tumor is a pretty damn low spot. And the next thing we know, he's going to live. The brain tumor has just made him really stupid. really, it's the truth. It was very difficult, very juvenilely stupid. Are you with me on that? Yep, I said the word stupid, so what? So, but very juvenile. It was very painful. I wanted to be married to a man, and he had turned into a 16-year-old boy. It was very difficult. But we were in it for the long haul, man. I was married to him, we were in it for the long haul. And next thing I know, he convinces some doc to give him pills. And I had no idea that we're sitting there with the malady on us, right? We were in the malady. We were both active in Alcoholics Anonymous. We weren't active in the 12 steps. We were active in the fellowship. You know, you got the triangle. Unity, service, recovery. We were active right there, not in recovery. I was doing 5 meetings a week. Next thing I know, Joe's off to the races, man. He's doing pills and everything. About 6 years into this brain tumor did I find out that he was going to the methadone clinic. And when I found out he was going to the methadone clinic, in 6 hours he was out of the house. That's what I do with the disease of alcoholism. It will not live under my roof. I love that man with all my heart. I'd have grown old with him. But the minute I found out he was using, done, deal, gone. Went to a counselor, Mac McLester, fabulous man. And he looked at Joe and he said, your ass is out. Go get in a halfway house. Joe was in a halfway house that next afternoon. Because that's how devastating the disease of alcoholism was. And in 18 months, he had 23 years sober. In 18 months, he was dead. He died of a heroin overdose. He could not get sober. And had he met Mark Houston, I think he could have, personally. You really want to know the truth? I don't believe anybody in the rooms that he was going to had the sufficient answer. They had the answer, let's go to a meeting. Today I understand that's not the best answer. Meetings are great. I'm a big fan of them. They are absolutely will not treat the disease of alcoholism. And so I got this kid who's pissed. He's 13. He's pissed. I sent him to military school. Oh, Jesus, I can't even begin to tell you what I did with this kid. I sent him to military school 14 days after his dad died. That's a pretty tough grill, isn't it? I knew he possibly had the disease, and it wasn't going to get me. It wasn't going to get him either if I could stop it. And he ended up running away. Shocking. Only 3 people have ever run away from that military school. Marine Military Academy in Harlingen, Texas. 3. My son was one of them. From 1966 till today. Only 3. Yeah. Which means he's either going to be the mayor or the head of the Hells Angel. I'm not quite sure. Ready? We got a creative one on our hands. And so, by the time this kid got back, I was absolutely crazy. My life was just in upheaval. And he ended up just making it miserable. I mean, I'm not sharing anything that you guys don't know. How many of you guys are raising an alcoholic kid? It's terribly painful. You're absolutely at a loss what to do with him. And so I have this, he's got a $10,000 inheritance coming to him when he's 18 years old. Well, first of all, he gets thrown in jail for a little minor felony. And I go to the courthouse, and I'm so furious. He's already cost me so much money. He's truant from school. I've called the police coming to arrest him. One time I called the police. I asked him to get the groceries out of the car, and he brings the grocery bag in, and he's all acting like an absolute turd, and he drops that bag like it's going to break to me. And I thought something broke, and I mean to tell you, I walked over there and just slapped the crap out of him. And I said, "Don't you ever do that again." And he just looked at me, and he started pelting stuff all over the house. And I called, "Does this sound familiar? Anybody live in this kind of insanity?" I called the police, and the woman goes, "Ma'am, does he have a weapon?" And I said, "I believe he does." See, that gets him there a whole lot faster. And the policeman comes. Of course, he has no weapon. By this time, my son's terribly remorseful because my son's a wonderful kid. He's a good kid. He's pissed that his dad's gone, and he's doing tons of dope. And so he says, the policeman goes, "Ma'am, what do you want me to do?" And I said, "You have a gun pointed at him. Shoot him in the leg. I really don't care right now. Somebody's got to have the alpha figure. This kid is running my house. I've lost the alpha figure. That's not good. I don't think our parents' parents lost the alpha figure, did they? Somewhere in the generations, the kids are running the show. It's absolutely a crying shame. You got to listen to me for another 7 minutes." So what ended up happening is he gets thrown in jail for a small felony, just third degree. And I'm down at the courthouse, and you know, for the juveniles. I've lived in Austin since I was 17, never knew where the juvenile hall was. But I drive down to the juvie center, and I get into the courtroom, and he's thrown a brick through a gas station window in the middle of the night and stolen the cigarettes. Now, he didn't steal the beer and wine, so there's a little silver lining here, but it's still a federal offense because it was cigarettes, by the way. It could have been brought down to a misdemeanor, but that's not the point. I'm sitting there in that courtroom, my daughter went with me, and they're 10 years apart, and I'm sitting over there, and I must be making a lot of racket. I don't know I am, right? Don't forget, I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. And the judge goes, "Ma'am, are you going to be okay?" I said, "No, I don't think I am." And he said, "Would you like to tell me what's going on?" If they had brought my son in that godforsaken orange outfit shackled, that's a proud moment for a parent. And I said, "You know what? Let me tell you something." I said, "I have been trying to get my son to spend one night in jail for truancy. One night. But I couldn't get him in jail because nobody would come pick him up. But now we got a third degree felony, and I'm sitting here in the courtroom, and I don't know why I'm here." And he said, "Well, ma'am, this is called a detainment hearing." I said, "I don't know what that means." See, little does he know is I am an alcoholic, but I never got arrested. So I don't know the criminal justice system. And he says, a detainment hearing is we're determining if he's going to go with you or stay here with us. And I went, "Oh, let me make that real easy right here, right now. He's staying here." And I swear, my son is all shackled. He goes like this. It's like, "Oh, yeah, who's got the alpha figure now, buddy, huh?" And I looked at him, and I told the judge, I said, "Let me tell you a little history." And in that courtroom was a police officer that at some point this particular police officer had told my son that he had rights when he ran away from that military school and that he never needed to go back. What an idiot. And that man happened to be sitting in that courtroom in his little police outfit. And I looked up at that judge and I said, it all started with that man right there. I swear to God, I fried him. I thought, you know what, I'm frying everybody. And so that judge, I told the judge what had happened, and I said, I'm telling you what, I said, this is a good kid. And I don't know what in the world is going to wake him up. But if something doesn't wake him up, he's going to be dead or in prison, period. Because see, that's what happens to us. That's what happens to us. What we are doing is illegal. We go to prison. Yeah. And when we're in prison, we're shocked. How did this happen? I swear to God. Oh, and then all of a sudden, then you got a really sniffling kid. And so I told that judge, he goes, how long do you want me to keep him? I said, how long can you keep him? And he goes, 2 weeks. I said, good. Well, two weeks. And my son is just the whole time. And I said, I'll tell you what, too, I'm not coming to visit him on visitation. I said, he is not at summer camp. And I said, so, because see, I couldn't talk to him. I said, so you tell him I'm not coming to visit him. I said, I heard he spit on a police officer when he was getting arrested. That is not the son I raised. I raised that boy in a sober home with principles, morals, values. And so the judge held up a piece of paper. It was a single sheet. And he looked at my son and he said, son, this is your file. Your mother is right. You do not belong here. I hope this is the most miserable 2 weeks of your life. And he just jumped his butt. And then he held up a kid's file like this. He said, this boy, he belongs here. I hope you get it this time. And I left out of there and a probation officer ran out after me and said, I got to tell you something. He came back there, yes ma'am in it and no sir in it. And I said, that's because he's a good boy. He really was raised with good values, and so were your kids. They were raised with good values. Most alcoholics are. And he turned his life around. He really started to get it together. And so he had this check. You're going to have to listen to me for 3 more minutes. He had this check, $10,000. He met this wonderful little girl. I was a little apprehensive. Oh, but they were 17. And he met this little girl, and he was going to get this check for $10,000. And I told him, I said, Sam, you cost me a lot of money. And I put it on the refrigerator. Every time you cost me money. And when you get this $10,000 check, I'm keeping it. It's mine. And he couldn't understand what an inheritance was, right? He was just too young. He didn't really get it because he'd never lived on his own. Heck, half these guys hadn't. And my husband included. And oh, the work he has been. So what ended up happening is Sam gets his check from 17 to 18. He turns his life around. I mean, he has turned his life around. He still dropped out of school, but he turned his life around. He started to get a job. He started working. And on his 18th birthday, he knew he was moving. And he said, Mom, let me get this straight. You know, about 2 weeks later, he got the check. He said, let me get this straight. This $10,000 check that I now have and live on my own, you're keeping it? And I said, absolutely, Sam. It's one of the toughest things I've ever had to do. Your life has been great for the last year. And I said, but I believe strongly in principle. And you need to learn a very valuable lesson. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you $2,000 and I'll keep $8,000. And we went to that bank and I cried. It was harder than sending him to military school after his father died. And I made him give me that $8,000 because I knew it was principle. And I hope you parents can pick up on some of this. You may need to work those 12 steps to be able to do this for your kids. But you will absolutely save your children's life. Do not make your decisions based on the fact that you think they're going to kill themselves. We just don't. We're too selfish and self-centered. We really are. We just want you to be scared enough to do whatever we want you to do for us. They're getting a great program out here. Best, I think, in the country. I'm telling you, the best in the country. And I don't say that if I don't believe in it. I come out here twice a month and talk to your kids. I can give you my phone number. Point your children out. I'll ride their ass. I have a whole herd that will ride your ass. You know, the treatment, the recovery center here can only do so much. They can really only do so much because of legal bounds. I can do whatever I want to do. And I will. And I sincerely mean that. Now, I will also tell you that your job is to work in an Al-Anon program and to pray. And if your kids are not doing well, do not talk to them. Do not answer the call. Do not text. Tell them you love them and you're done. And don't just in the middle of everything shoot them a text that says, I love you. Don't do that. They need to be completely cut off so that they no longer have the most important thing to them, and that is family. Thank you very much.